Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 24th of February. It is 13 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock, and it's very nice to have you with us. Hopefully, you're all, we were just talking about this in the studio. Hopefully, you're all dug out from the snow that didn't come.
depending on where you live.
Yes, I know there were parts of our listening area that got buried. It seems that the place on the eastern seaboard that got really smashed was Providence, Rhode Island, like 38 inches or something. My God. And so, yeah, hearts out to them. But New York City, 20, 25, 30 inches, and a lot going on there. And so how about Poughkeepsie?
Yeah, Poe Vegas, as we call it, got somewhere between. I cleared it myself, so that means I'm a very unreliable estimator because I always increase the total.
I was going to say masculine, but okay.
But when and of course when I have to pay for it by the inch, I think there's a lot less than there actually was. But I think it was 8 to 12 would be my estimate. The issue for clearing it was it had been warm when it started and warm when it ended. So if you were using a snowblower, it got tough because it got heavy.
Very heavy and mushy.
Exactly.
I would like to, we don't usually do this, but I'd like to do this morning. I would like to dedicate today's program to the U.S. Olympic women's hockey team. I think it is necessary to commend them for their incredible victory, but more so because when they were dissed by the president, and then subsequently invited to the State of the Union address, they cited scheduling concerns, and told him to take a trip, and they're not coming. And I just want to honor them for that. The men's hockey team apparently said yes, but they weren't dissed.
Yeah,
it was sort of an afterthought.
Not only were they not dissed, they had the FBI director
In
the locker room with him.
Yeah, partying it up.
I tell you, the focus has been on whether or not taxpayers paid for that, and apparently they had a security discussion about the upcoming Olympics, so the FBI director had to be
New excuse?
That was the excuse. I don't know that I care as much, given all the waste and corruption and graft in this administration, about whether or not people paid for it. What's amazing to me is, can you imagine like William Webster or another former FBI director in the locker room spraying beer under those circumstances? It just, I don't know, was dignity of the office something about
no,
that?
No, well, I mean, that ship has sailed, hasn't it? I mean, that's sort of gone by the wayside. But So again, we dedicate this show to the women's U.S. women's hockey team, who will not be at the State of the Union today. And by the way, the invitation is out. If they want to stop by here, they're more than welcome to. Yeah, come on by. It'll be great.
So which team got the better part in the end is the open question.
Oh well, I think we know the answer to that question, but.
I don't know. Is he going to buy like the Burger King stuff again, McDonald's or whatever it was?
That's right.
For football?
We keep forgetting all of this good stuff. All right. We have a lot to talk about, a lot going on, and we'll get started. Let me introduce the group to you. Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Henler is here. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing okay.
Good to have you here. Allison Cavey joins us, full professor in the history department of John Jay College of Criminal Justice. It's a CUNY school, you know.
It's definitely one of those.
Yeah, SUNY, CUNY. It's really great to have you here. Thank you very much. We were asking everybody about their storm totals, but were you okay down there?
We had a pretty good blizzard.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, were you in the city then, or were you just
no,
in
I live in Millbrook,
yeah.
So it was quite blizzardy. We had the 50-mile-an-hour winds and then no visibility and drifts that are over my head, and I'm pretty tall.
Well, I'm glad you're here. Thank you very much for being here. Former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain joins us. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Wonderful to have you here. Mark Wibben was with us yesterday via telephone. Today, we have him in person. Investment banker on Wall Street. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm good. Much better day when I can be here in person and not have to clear snow for the good part of my remainder of the day.
It's a yes. That's a good. That's a good thing, isn't it? All right. So we were having a discussion prior to the show, and I'm gonna turn this over to Mark because I really don't understand it. We're gonna talk in a bit about the State of the Union address. The State of the Union address is tonight. It will be broadcast here on WAMC. You can listen to it, or you can watch it, or you can avoid it. Those are your only options. Right. But you have the opportunity to hear it here on WAMC. We're going to have a bit of a preview on the State of the Union. Yesterday, the president gave a preview, and he said it's going to be really long. So just know that going into it, and I don't know exactly what that means, but we'll find out. But the story that I'm curious about is tariffs for the moment, because I know this is going to be a big issue that's going to come up during the State of the Union address. So you remember that the Supreme Court on Friday deemed the president's by a 6-3 vote. Allison was here when that news came down. We were live in the studio when that happened. And they deemed that that was illegal, and they blocked it. They said, you can't do that. You can't. It's overreaching for a president to do that. You can't do it. So then the president said, okay, well, we're going to do a global tariff of 10%. We're going to do a global tariff of 10%. And then he slept on it. If he sleeps, he slept on it. And then in the morning, he said, this is Saturday morning, he said, it's 15%. 15%. So we went through Saturday. We went through Sunday as people were, you know, getting ready for the 15% global tariffs. And then we are greeted this morning with the news that it has now been reduced to 10%. Now, we can talk about, I guess, the economics of all of this, but I just I'm going to use hopefully Mike won't mind. I'm going to use a really he gets after me sometimes for using overly technical language, but the willy-nilly nature of the could be 5, could be 10, could be 15, could be 25, could be 30, could be 100. Where are these numbers coming from?
Joe, my understanding is when the Supreme Court shut down the tariffs, the administration was acutely concerned that there would be a tremendous influx of goods at the ports, which would sort of drive home for the American public the costs that they've been paying, and so and the limited choices that have resulted from these tariffs. So the administration immediately went to 10%. There was also concern over the weekend that the bond market might be worried, because to the extent that the administration has to give back proceeds from these tariffs or can't take them in the future, the bond market would expect that there would be more government debt issued. I think that concern, I thought at the time that it was overblown. I think that we're so in debt, I don't know that this matters at the margin currently. And so the administration went to 15%. My understanding, and I've looked at a couple sources, including the Financial Times, is that the world's reaction is why we're at 10. The UK, and 10 is closer to the watermark that we've got with other countries than the 15%. So there are countries like the UK that were saying, hey, we just cut a deal with you. If you do this to 15% globally, don't make us regret it. And Downing Street actually hinted at retaliation. The EU, which still hasn't but was about to ratify its tariff agreement with the United States, also put that on delay. Japan, which had cut a big auto deal and promised one of these big investments in the United States, these illusory don't put them on your calendar investments, said, wait a second, does this apply to us or not? And they had had discussions with the administration. And one of those who they had, one of those that, that these countries had in aggregate had discussions with included that undercover genius, Howard Lutnick. And Taiwan decided that it was going to delay its own approval of its a deal with Washington again because they wanted to, they wanted guarantees that the new global tariffs wouldn't override it. So, and you almost finished with the story, but the story goes on.
Yeah.
The yo-yo continues to go up and down, which is Donald Trump said it's 10, but just hang on, it's about that 15. There's more to come once we do a little bit of research and a little bit of work around it. So he's even put in the 10, and yet we don't have a stopping point for any extended period of time.
If he were alive, Tommy Smothers would be an advisor.
Yeah, which goes back to Frank.
Do you get that reference? Do you get that reference, Mike?
That Tommy Smothers. Oh, tell us what it is.
Tommy Smothers was the yo-yo man.
Right. Oh, the yo-yo man.
Yes, okay. One of his things. He would come out and would do like 2 hours of yo-yo
stuff. That's true. I thought you meant he was
the brother,
willy-nilly man.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, some of my fellow panelists yesterday took me to task a little bit because it's hard to look at this and not responsibly talk about the pain that it's going to cause individuals and businesses, both in the United States and frankly around the world. But I do think you just need to squint really hard, almost so hard you can't see the eye chart, and just say to yourself, until Donald Trump is no longer president, the tariff policy of this country will be capricious, unpredictable, and will continue to cost Americans a substantial amount of money. And I think to come down any more specifically than that is impossible, given that we're dealing with Trump and his whims. And a president that he's supposed to turn to his cabinet typically, right, and rely on good sage advice. But if you tell me where sage advice is coming from, you know, other than the spice cabinet for Trump, I don't know where.
But the question still exists, and this is for the group at large, I guess, is that back to the willy-nilly nature. Is it even when you go to sell this, and I know common sense doesn't play a part here, but if you go to sell this to the American people tonight, it seems as though, you know, we're changing on a dime. It's hard to say we got this when we keep on saying. You know, I keep on thinking of the people, and I'm sure you've played with them, where you play Monopoly, and they're the people that say, "Well, you take all of the money that you collect, and you put it under free parking, and then if you land on that, you get that money." And then people say, "Well, that's not a real rule." And then people say, "Well, yes, it is." And then you go back and forth, and then half the people take the money, half the people don't take the money. I'm likening our current tariff policy to free parking.
Yeah, or if you've ever played Uno with a child who has different rules at school than you
have
at home.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is just Trump plays Uno and the rules change depending on what space he's landed on. This is clear. But the whole point though is, again, I think you could just ignore the specifics from now until the end of his presidency. It doesn't matter. He's going to put in place a policy that's going to tax Americans, you know, $100 billion plus a year. It's going to decrease our choices in terms of goods that come in from abroad. It's going to decrease the reliability of the United States as both an economic and a political partner to the extent that Trump continues to try and use these as a cudgel. And it's not going to have a significant effect in increasing jobs in the United States. And even worse, it's going to basically freeze corporate economic decisions until there's more clarity on the other side of another administration. I don't honestly, the rest of it from now until the end of his presidency, the endless legal cases and the articles and the op-eds. I mean, Howard Lutnick, there was an op-ed in the Financial Times that was allegedly authored by Howard Lutnick. Now, if you believe that. You know, I've got a bridge and so I'm just not going to focus on the rest of it. It just doesn't, this guy's messed it up and he's going to continue to mess it up until he's no longer president.
Anybody else want to weigh in on the?
Well, I guess I just want to add something about his total disregard for Congress. He said I don't have to go to Congress to do this. I've already done it. These have already been approved. And that's because he's had his little ferrets ferreting around in the legal code trying to find places that he can assign these tariffs. And that's, of course, what he's doing here, right?
Tomorrow's show will dedicate to ferrets.
I have nothing against ferrets.
Nor
I
do
love
I.
a ferret.
Yes.
But
they smell.
They do. But in this case, I am not saying that his lawyers smell. I am saying they are pretty good at reading the code that allowed them to find some places to do this. But it does worry me that we have 150 days at this 10 to 15% tax rate. And then he does have to either find another loophole or move on to Congress. And he has simply said, I don't have to do that. Now, Joe, to your point, which I think is worth making, how is he going to make this case to the American people? He's not. He consistently says, tariffs are great, tariffs are great. I'm going to build American industry. While there is no evidence that any of that is happening, he does not care. He's not an evidence-based thinker, and neither are the people who voted for him. So they don't care. They do care that they're paying more money. They do care that there are fewer options, but they're not connecting the dots at the speed that would be required. Will this affect him in the midterms? Yeah, I hope so.
Unless someone has a 30-second quip, I'm going to take a break. Okay. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with the program, and we're going to go to the BBC News. And when we come back, we'll talk more about tariffs, but we'll also get a preview of what's coming up in the State of the Union address, which will be delivered tonight. Again, we're told that it is going to be a long address, where the president will be making his case before the American people. And the only thing that struck me about that is if anyone has seen one of those rallies that goes on for 3.5 hours, when he says long, I get a little nervous, but that's okay because all of it will be broadcast right here on WAMC tonight. We will be back right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have a great group this morning. Jim Hendler is here, Allison Cavey, Mike Spain, and Mark Whitman. We're very happy. I'm glad Jim's here. I got a question for Jim. So I was on my Hulu app, all right, and my Hulu app has a section on it called Inspired by What You Watch. All right. Mm-hmm. And so I checked in this morning and it said, because you watched, wait for it, Dawson's Creek, which I have been watching because we lost James Vanderbeek. And that show is very nostalgic for me. I think even when it was started, when it was on, I was too old to watch it. I was still like a married man at that point. But it was something about the angst that just drew me in, that teenage angst, that I became a big fan of the show. So I've been rewatching Dawson's Creek. Well, this morning I go to my Hulu app and it says, Inspired by What You Watch, because you watched Dawson's Creek, and I'm thinking it's going to say Beverly Hills 90210, Melrose Place, One Tree Hill. No. Because you watch Dawson's Creek, Hulu recommends Wu-Tang, An American Saga. Explain that algorithm to me, Jim, because I, for the life of me, can't figure it out.
So, you know, we're doing an AI show on Vox Pop today. Maybe it'll be better.
Okay, you can handle it there.
But seriously. There are so many different kinds of these recommender algorithms. They've been around for a long time. I mean, now that we're all talking about AI, suddenly all these things, I mean, how long have been using GPS or Waze or something? But suddenly it's an AI thing, right? Well, it is, but not. You know, not ChatGPT. So these recommenders have been around for a long time. But Joe, the real answer is this. One of the strangest things about recommendations, the early recommenders said, let's say I gave you 50 movies to rank, and then I gave someone else 50 movies to rank. I would match them up, and I'd say, oh, the places where you are most similar would be the best recommendations. But it turns out that's wrong. what turned out to be the best recommenders are the ones where you were most different from the average in the same way I was. So if you hated some very popular movie that I also hated, that outweighs the other 49. And so now they're just doing that with millions and millions of people. And so somewhere along the line, the people who love Dawson's Creek when other people don't also...
Well, I'm watching Wu-Tang tonight. I know that much.
And there's
but
a
what about the State of the Union show?
I'm watching Wu-Tang tonight. Buddy.
There's a very famous there's a very famous TED Talk that was given by one of my former students. It only got 3 or 4 million views, which was I think it's called Curly Fries or something. And it's why in these very early AI recommendations, this is from like 10 or 12 years ago, the fact that you like curly fries tended to correspond well with your intelligence, right? And she went through the whole math of how this works, but it's basically, you know, what you like, who likes, da-da-da, you know, we now all talk about social networks and bubbles and stuff, but it turns out that's not really the thing that's killing us. What's killing us is that as things get more and more separate, there's more and more places where those minor agreements outweigh the major, minor agreements outweigh the major variance. So the fact that we happen to agree on a lot of stuff but disagree on one political issue will cause that issue to get reintroduced and reintroduced, and that, of course, builds more of the polarism. And it turns out this is even more important than what we call information bubbles and things like that. So it's crazy.
So... let us talk about the State of the Union, which will be given tonight as President Trump prepared to deliver his State of the Union address. He gave a little glimpse on Monday and on what Americans can expect. It's going to be a long speech, he said, because we have so much to talk about. We find that to be the case on this show. We have so much to talk about, including it. Our Hulu preferences. The president spent part of the weekend preparing for Tuesday's address by reviewing the speech with a small group of advisors. Mr. Trump has long eschewed traditional preparation for major events such as joint addresses to Congress or presidential debates. He does not like to practice reading the speech out loud.
Or reading at all.
But he spent time mimicking the setup of the House chamber, according to those who were there. The speech comes at a political and... Take two. The speech comes at a critical juncture in Mr. Trump's presidency. Poll shows approval ratings sliding. Republicans fear they will lose control of at least one chamber of Congress. The Supreme Court just ruled against the president's signature tariff policy, and he is considering military action against Iran. He is expected to host the traditional lunch on Tuesday with anchors from the 5 main networks. Officials said Mr. Trump also invited guests from new media outlets. They declined to specify which anchors would be attending the lunch. Mike Spain, what do you make of this particular address and what we can expect tonight?
Well, you know, they say 30 million people will be watching, but a lot more people will be getting clips tomorrow on social media or watching morning television, et cetera, watching CNN or Fox News. And so what he says will get out there. Now, it's really important. I saw in Politico, they say the only thing matters is whether Trump can stay on message before this huge crowd that are going to be watching it or seeing it after the fact. And you know that he can easily drift off message and stop looking at the teleprompter, start talking about the 2020 election. And if he does that, I think that's going to be problematic. Also, the Supreme Court is going, some members of the Supreme Court will be sitting right in front of them, and probably Chief John Roberts. And he'll be tempted to personally attack him verbally and attack the court verbally, and that'll be bad for him. And the odd thing is there are some things he could talk about that have been positive. You know, there's the borders are tight. Shut the way that he promised he would do it. There's been some reductions in pharmaceutical prices. There's been big tax cuts for certain people. Gas prices are down. He'll probably gloss right over that and try to defend his policy going forward, which, what is his policy going forward?
Tariffs.
Right. And you know, his assertion over the weekend and yesterday that there's plenty of laws on the books that allow him to impose tariffs. So he doesn't need to go back to Congress, and, you know, all that needs to be tested out. But I think it's, as you said, Joe, he promises a long address. And if he meanders, it could be like a bad time, a bad moment for him before, because I think people are going to be paying attention.
Well, I hope it doesn't bump us tomorrow morning.
I think it'll be the topic tomorrow morning.
that's true. You know, Mark, a question I was going to ask you earlier on tariffs, and Mike just brought it up, so it seems apropos of what we're talking about of the State of the Union. But when we look at a 10% or 15% or whatever it ends up being, do we have a sense right now of how much that is different than the tariff schedule that was previously in place on last Thursday?
Yeah, if Trump puts in the 15%, he'll be about, I've heard the estimate, he'll be about 7/8 in aggregate in terms of the amount of money that the United States is taking in. The effect on will be different if you look below the surface in terms of some importers versus others. And the assumption is once the 150-day period is over and he legs into the other authorizations that are available to him, he'll probably be about 6/8 of where he was. So the answer is he can pretty much put the wall back together and get back to where he was. Now, that assumes what he's going to do after the first 150 days survives legal challenge, and that's where I go to the I'm done. I'm putting down my scorecard on this game, and I'm going to just assume that he's going to be about at that level one way or the other to the end of his presidency, even without going back to Congress.
Can I ask you a question, Mark? The China was paying a lot more than 10 or 15%. Is that right?
I think the threat, yes, China was paying a lot more, but there are different, you know, cars, steel have always been different, so they're outside of this. There are places where he's got latitude, you know, beyond.
So he can keep it higher for China, perhaps, using one of those clauses.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I was going to say, is China going to start sending over products at a lower price now, essentially, because there's only a 10% tariff on them, or a 15%, whatever it amounts to, rather than the 50% that he imposed last year when he was angry at them?
Yeah, if you go country by country, I'm sure that there are momentary windows when Trump is switching mechanisms that present themselves to importers. But the question is, you know, that stuff takes a while to get over on the boat, and even during that period of transit, there's a risk that things will change. And there's also the political considerations of, you know, do you want to let your importers flood the United States and risk Trump's ire in the meantime? And so I think that'll round the edges, as opposed to see people, you know, doing the hokey pokey every time the regime changes.
Jim?
So I want to go back to the State of the Union. You know, what I find both interesting and to some degree troubling is, so you have what are they calling it? The State of the Swamp event that will be going on outside, where
event, yeah.
30 Democratic congresspeople and a number of other speakers will be. But then you also have another one at the National Press Club doing a sort of a hour thing at the same time. And I'm like, you know, sort of, this is like the Democrats yet again. The good news is we all agree we don't like Trump. They all agree they don't like Trump. The bad news is they're going to two or three different places.
Well, they still have those placards like they did last time, where they can go yay or nay every time he speaks. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I expect we'll see a lot of standing up and clapping by half of the room, and standing up and booing by the other, or not booing by the other half.
Won't be the same without Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Yeah, it's true.
Tom Massey will be there.
Yes, that's.
I mean, that's an interesting point. Who is going to bring whom? And some Democrat members of Congress who are going to be there are going to bring women who are victims of, you know, Jeffrey Epstein. And that's a very awkward optic. And I think that the TVs will focus on that. And I think that is going to be harmful for Trump's
You know, stature. I think yeah. Getting back to what Mike said before, one of the things I see is that a lot of his positives also come with negatives, right? So the sealed border is tied to ICE.
Sure.
And right, then, and which it, right, has right. a very negative connotation right now in the polling, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I mean, I think it's going to be I'm sure his script writers are writing a very careful trail through a lot of stuff.
which is second, sort of like useless.
And the problem, it's like looking at a tightrope as soon as he steps off. So it's going to, you know, it could be interesting. I look forward to seeing the video clips tomorrow morning because there's no way I'm going to watch this.
But this is the thing. It seems like we've had this discussion every year when the State of the Union comes about, no matter who is about to take the podium, and that is, well, does it mean anything? I mean, we know what whoever gets up there isn't going to say the State of the Union sucks. I know he's going to say that. So everybody is going to tell you how great it is, and then they're going to set out an agenda, which in most cases you already know. It's been mentioned. Certainly with this president, you have in real time of being told what's gonna happen, and so I guess it brings sort of an overall question of the importance of such addresses, and Mike mentioned numbers of how many people will view it. I mean, yes, it's a spectacle, it's something to see, but does it really do anything?
It can move the needle, both positive and negative. I mean, I remember 2 years ago, Joe Biden got up there and gave a pretty good State of the Union address. Yeah. And then Trump suggested he was caffeined up or even cocained up or some ridiculous thing like that. But it did help Biden for a very short time. And it helped him get some momentum, which probably in the end was too bad because it made him stay in the race much too long. He should have been out by then. But in any event, it can move the needle. Presidents have been inspiring over the decades in State of the Union addresses. They have said things that are memorable and, you know, have been repeated and they can, you know, hold on to over the years. But right now, I do worry that, I mean, I almost wonder if it's going to be like the Biden June 2024 debate with Trump where he gets up there and he starts rambling just the way Biden did during that horrible debate for Biden. I mean, it could be a disaster, and I don't know what that will do.
Yeah, and so, I don't know what that looks like, and also he's debating himself.
So, yeah. Well, it hasn't stopped him in the past.
No. Hold that point, Jim, because I'm going to take a quick break. We'll get that in, and then we'll go to everybody here around the bend. We welcome you, panel at WAMC panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Just saw a flashing light, and it distracted me, and I apologize. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We've got a good one going here. 51 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock on this 24th day of February. We're continuing to talk about the State of the Union. Allison.
So I think one thing that Trump does need to consider, not that he's probably considering anything, is that his core supporters who brought him in on immigration and economics are no longer supporting him on those two fronts. So ICE and the violence and consistent constitutional violations have dropped his support for immigration reform. And there has been a consistent uptick in the realization that he is not arresting criminals and deporting them, but in fact, he's taking people who have built lives here out of their homes, putting them in warehouses in Dilley, Texas. He's imprisoning children. And the drip, drip, drip of excellent press coverage that we're seeing from Politico and from other outlets suggests that, in fact, more and more people are aware of the number of children who are being detained and the women who are being sexually assaulted in the ICE facilities. The second thing he needs to pay attention to is people are not happy about tariffs. He might love them. They might be his favorite word. But for the people who are seeing an additional $3 to $6 on every single thing they purchase at the grocery store, there is a pretty consistent level of rage. They liked going to Walmart and buying things inexpensively. They do not like to see the same things more expensive so that the people who sell them can make the same amount of money. If income does not keep up with inflation, which is essentially what we're looking at here, people become sad, and they do not vote you back in.
Jim?
Yeah. I was going to say something. No, I think the real question I have is, if you look at Trump's first State of the Union about 8 years ago, it was pure performative politics done extremely well. I mean, people still remember, and I think it was either his first or second, the giving of the Medal of Freedom to Rush Limbaugh, whether you loved it or hated it, was clearly a moment. You know, he created moments. He was a great showman, right? Now he's not anymore, and is not doing it as well. So it's going to be really interesting to see how he tries to pull that stuff off. He had a military veteran come in and see his family for the first time. He really ran it like a reality TV show. But he also was good at scripting that. And I think what's going to be interesting, in both senses of interesting, is can he even do that sort of thing anymore? Will he even try to pull off these kind of surprises that were essentially, you know, we say dog whistles to his base, but a dog whistle is sort of not the same as a throwing raw meat to your lions, which is what he's been doing the past few speeches. So it's really, you know, I would guess tonight's going to be a raw meat, attack your enemies, beat them over the head. And you know, it's still performative, but it's not going to be that same kind of well-crafted thing that he used to be able to do. We've seen him slipping in that, and I think that's just going to keep happening.
Well, I'll go back to what Allison said about not having the support afterwards, and it's the midterms that the Republicans are so desperately worried about, and I think for that reason there's a lot of pressure even within the White House, his advisors, you know, Susie Wiles and others who seem to have some impact on his behavior, are going to be doing everything they can to keep him reined in so that he doesn't make it worse for the other members of, you know, the majority right now, the very slim majority right now, as they head into the November elections, because it, by all indications, or nearly all indications, despite the disunity of the Democratic Party, they're looking at big gains this November.
Anybody else on that? All right. I want to go to just a few letters, and then we'll take a break at the top of the hour. And when we come back, we'll move on and talk about many, many other things going on. Good morning. The two Democratic events competing with the State of the Union begin at different times, one at 7, the other at 8:30. People will be able to see both. That is true. So we have that.
That's fair.
Yes. Some smart Alex writing to us this morning who say, just wondering if it's a long speech, can he stay awake and on his feet for all of it? That seems like a mean statement, but I'll read it anyway. I think that Trump's largest disappointment with the tariff decision is that foreign leaders will no longer be traveling to Washington to kiss his ring and buy his Bitcoin, so he will change a tariff for them.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of it. The new way he's invoking our old laws that let him invoke more broadly tariffs, and specific, as you were saying, Mark, you know, when it comes to special imports like steel or whatever. He doesn't have that unilateral, 15, we'll give you 10. Oh, how about, no, you made me angry, it's going to be 20. You know, that kind of thing. He doesn't have that that authority anymore. That was taken away Friday by the Supreme Court. So that's good. I mean, people will not need to come to Washington and suck up to him, basically.
Yeah, I think that letter writer's on to a point. I think the weapons that Trump has at his disposal are a lot less sharp. They're more they're blunter than they were last time, which is not to say that he doesn't still have a great degree of sway. And we've certainly seen him outside of tariffs in terms of pressure put on different institutions that he can use sway in a lot of. He can use, and I would argue, abuse presidential power to influence things in he's still got a lot of levers he can pull, unfortunately.
Here's a question I get occasionally from people who say, what are the letters that you don't read on the air that come in during the panel? And I said, well, you know, they're usually not chosen for a reason, but, you know. I think I would just like to read one of those now. And I'm going to give it an impassioned reading because I just like it. It's not a bad letter. It's just I think it shows that not always what we are talking about is of what is on someone's mind. All right. This is from Marion. And Marion says, you guys are educated enough to understand the difference between an adjective and a noun. Democrat legislators is a pejorative stated by conservatives who can't bear to imply that politicians from the Democratic Party practice democratic principles. These insults came predominantly from Southern politicians, where their regional dialect and educational ignorance was to some degree an excuse. The continuation of this defect by educated people on your panel is insulting. Do you have to jump on board as well? For 200 years, we had Democrats who were Democratic politicians from the Democratic Party, and everyone understood what we were talking about. Okay.
Marion, thank you so much for that letter, but you're wrong. For many, many years, Democrats were, in fact, Southern racists who did not believe in democracy, but the ongoing upholding of racist policies, including segregation in the South. So if you'd like us to call them Democrats, which I think we all were doing, we're referring to the modern Democratic Party, which has not been around for 200 years. Thanks again.
We'll take a break. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. 7 minutes past 10 o'clock on this 24th day of February. We're going to move on and talk about other subjects after talking about both tariffs and the State of the Union. So let's go to Iran and attack concerns. Trump's top general foresees acute risks in an attack on Iran. We're being told, and maybe we will learn more tonight with the president speaking about this particular issue. The last couple of days have said that there was going to be, I believe, the reporting over the weekend in several publications, including the Washington Post and the New York Times, was that the president was considering a strike and then followed by a longer attack after that. Now, General Dan Kane, the Joint Chiefs of Staff chairman, has calculated that a lack of munitions and support from allies could mean greater danger for U.S. troops. As the Trump administration weighs an attack on Iran, the Pentagon's top general has cautioned President Trump and other officials that shortfalls in critical munitions and a lack of support from allies will add significant risk to the operation and to U.S. personnel, according to people familiar with those internal discussions. General Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, expressed his concerns at a White House meeting last week with President Trump and his top aides, cautioning that any major operation against Iran will face challenges because the U.S. munitions stockpile has been significantly depleted by Washington's ongoing defense of Israel and support for Ukraine. Kane's remarks at the White House meeting have not previously been reported. Separately, in Pentagon meetings this month, Kane also has raised concerns about the scale of any Iran campaign, its inherent complexity, and the possibility of U.S. casualties. The general has said that any operation would be made all the more difficult by a lack of allied support, this person said, speaking like others on the condition of anonymity to discuss private conversations. In a statement, Kane's office said that in his role as the president's top military advisor, the chairman, quote, provides a range of military options as well as secondary considerations and associated impacts and risks to the civilian leaders who make America's security decisions. Mike Spain.
One side thing first, the Washington Post, even in its diminished capacity after the huge layoffs that Jeff Bezos inflicted on the newsroom last week or a week before, they still did some pretty fine reporting here. And, you know, the Pentagon has been kind of kicking mainstream organizations out and making it difficult for them. So I do commend them. This is good information because people are wanting to know, what are we planning? You know, what's the goal here? Is it regime change? Is it simply to end their nuclear capacity, which we claimed that we did when we bombed them 5 months ago? You know, what's the point here? Maybe we'll learn more tonight in the State of the Union address. But I think that the fact that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dan Kane, is warning the president that this is a difficult way to go, and of the many risks involved, is good, because Trump seems to, at least up to now, seems to have relied on him, and they seem to have a good relationship. Hopefully, he'll be able to persuade the president not to get us into a long-term mired situation that he envisions as one outcome of this kind of thing.
So, let me be even more cynical than usual, right? I actually think what's going on here, to a large degree, has very little to do with what's going on in Iran per se. I mean, when you try to look at U.S. military objectives in Iran, it's really hard to say what they are.
Yeah.
But if you look at Saudi goals against Iran, if you look at some of the other players in that region, and I'd include Israel, although not so much for the reason I'm about to say, but the players with a lot of money would like to see Iran taken out. And they are the ones who have been funding Trump, his family. I mean, literally billions of dollars he has made as president, arguably legally. We go there separately. But I actually think a lot of the pressure on him is coming from what they call that Middle Eastern crescent, where it's the people who'd like to see Iran reduced as the power in the region. And those are the people, I mean, those are the guys who gave Trump the $200 million airplane. Those are the people who gave his kids the $2 billion deals.
Crypto investment?
Yeah. I mean, and on and on and on. And, you know, the level of corruption going on in this government is just amazing. But I do think that, you know, the two options are a major thing that's going to last a long time or some kind of limited strike like we did last time. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see him do some kind of limited strike, argue that it's, you know, accomplished what it needed to do like he did last time, and then move on, because 2 weeks later we'll have forgotten. And they're taking advantage of this just ability to just keep rolling things over and over and over again, to, you know, make it so, you know, this will be in the, as you said, you know, we bombed Iraq a few months ago, that, like,
Iran.
People are reading these articles and saying, oh yeah, we did that, didn't we? I mean,
didn't that end their nuclear capability when we did that?
But I mean, it just seems like years and years ago. I mean, it's just things keep piling up.
Allison.
So apparently Steve Witkoff told Fox News over the weekend the president is, quote, curious why Iran hasn't, quote, capitulated to U.S. demands given the looming threat of a military attack. Has he met Iran? They don't just capitulate. I mean, it's been hundreds of years of them saying pretty consistently, nah, we're good. We're better at fighting in the desert than you are. And the one thing that Trump campaigned on was to end the never-ending wars, to get America out of longstanding military engagements. And all he's done so far is take over Venezuela and now aim a lot of missiles at Iran for the second time in 5 months. I don't feel like we're getting out of the never-ending wars. And I think, other than never get involved in a land war in Asia, we should probably not get involved in a land war in the Middle East either. These are lessons we could learn from the Princess Bride.
Always.
Mark Whitman.
I heard the quote. By the way, I was wrong about Iran. I thought we'd be dropping bombs over the weekend.
You did say that. Yes.
So let me just.
You owe Bo money.
I know it's a gentleman's bet, but I do owe Bo. He was right.
Yeah.
That's all right. I dole those out every day. You'll never guess to who. So I first of all, the exchange with Witkoff, and then a leader in Iran said, "Well, you don't need to wonder. It's because we're Iranian." I think that's a little bit romanticized, and I do think you need to look at that statement more carefully to understand the trouble we still face in Venezuela, and the trouble we would face in Iran if we try to effectuate regime change. And then I want to talk about how Trump has boxed himself in, and I think the good news goes back to the playbook of Trump for Dummies. If you look carefully at the statement, well, that's because we're Iranian, the real answer is no. That's because we, the regime, are afraid that we and perhaps our families will lose our heads in the street if we are no longer the ruling government. And the same holds, by the way, for those who are still in power in Venezuela, which is why it is so hard to get these regimes to change. I would applaud Trump and the administration. The fact that they've been enforcing sanctions against Venezuela by actually hunting down the dark fleet of transport vessels that are selling oil around the world, I frankly think if you want to talk about military force, the slow sort of Python-like application of that sort of force around the world is what will get these regimes closer to the point where the people in power say, hey, how about that flight to Geneva for me and my family? Now, in terms of Trump boxing himself in, this is delicious again. I think we talked about it on a previous show, that some of the target list that Trump will inevitably use is the target list that Israel couldn't get to because Trump wanted to be the man who called the question on stopping the fighting the first time around. If he'd been a little bit less impetuous, it probably would, in my estimation, it would have been prudent to allow Israel, believe it or not, to do some more pruning here. The other thing that Trump has done is he used a month's worth of ordnance on the Houthis to effectively no meaningful effect. And they're not gonna talk about it in these press reports because nobody wants to leak that. Like, yeah, we spent all this stuff on Trump trying to bomb the Houthis into submission, which never really worked, frankly. So that's another delicious irony here. It is frightening to see the likes of the Wall Street Journal in one of their opinion pieces. The title, talk about yellow journalism. The title literally was, I'm on the back of the Wall Street Journal's opinion page lately. The title literally was, Iran is doing to Trump what Syria did to Obama. I mean, talk about trying to goad the White House into action here. But I think the good news is back to Trump for Dummies, right? I mean, talking about a sustained military campaign over weeks. What thought can Donald Trump hold in his head on a unified basis for weeks? That the answer is not maybe tariffs, but not many others.
He's not on the Epstein list. He's been totally exonerated.
Right. That's well, that one too. But my
again
point is
again and again and again.
He's the good news is he doesn't want to do that. The bad news is, and I think the Iranians are going to learn that. I frankly think somebody who's intelligent in this administration, even while the bombs are flying, are going to tell the Iranians, look, we got them down to a small target package. If you don't do anything stupid, this is it. But if you do something stupid, don't lose sight of the fact that we have more military force amassed in the Middle East than we've had since the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's inevitable that he's got to take out a bunch of the longer range missiles because Saudi doesn't want to lose desalinization. Yep. The Israelis don't want to sit there and lean into a left hook as part of this. He obviously, if there's something in the nuclear program that we think has been reconstituted, there's no harm in opening the can on that and going after it. And he's got to spank the regime a little bit so that he can make good on his promise to the protesters in Iran. The good news is there's a way through here. Again, I think we're going to send less than we could, and somebody's going to tell the Iranians, you know, this could have been a lot more personal, i.e. we could have gone after the supreme leader, or we could have been more extensive, and they're going to give them a way out. I think they'll take it because being bombed and embarrassed is being better than being bombed and dead for them, or being, as I say, sort of exterminated in the street, which would happen if there was a real revolution there.
And they will do something very visible and very large scale that doesn't affect much if your waypoint. That's what's happened in the past. So Iran, you know, sends a zillion missiles that aren't going to get through. But to their people, they report that, hey, we just had a zillion missiles and look at the damage it did by showing the two or three missile hits.
Well, that's what they did last
time.
Yeah, a couple of times. Just to get clear, I mean, Iran doesn't want us to really go at it. And they don't want that so much that they in the past have doctored photos of damage to try and make it look like we hit less than we did and published those. They literally got caught AI modifying photos of damage saying it wasn't that bad. And some of the retaliations in terms of the missiles that they've sent, they literally called in advance and told us what they were going to hit.
Yeah, that's
so amazing. So that the United States could shoot it down and they wouldn't kill a bunch of American servicemen because they knew that would further put Trump into a box. I am not issuing any guarantees, but I do think if you look at the school of Trump for Dummies and you look at the Iranians' incentives here, there's a way through, even though Trump has unfortunately decided that he's got to drop something. Ordinance.
Anyone else on that? All right, couple letters. Let's go to those. We go to Ellen. My fear is that Trump is taking a page from Bibi's and Putin's book, Start a War, Stay in Power. That from Ellen. Then we go to Norma. What is the reason to attack Iran apart from distracting from Epstein files and doing the bidding of Israel? Leave the people of Iran in peace.
I agree with that, although I would say in my book, anytime you see any site connected with their nuclear program that's made progress, I think there's a clear reason why you would hit that, but I don't think that's going to generally involve killing a lot of people. So I agree with that letter with the amendment that I've offered.
Well, and the other amendment I'd add is this constant saying it's Israel is a very good excuse for not saying it's a lot of these other countries that are giving a lot of money in corrupt ways to the Trump administration.
All right. Anybody else?
Oh, no. I underscore what Jim says. I think it is certainly not just for Israel. I think the Arab countries with which have supported Trump definitely don't want the dominance of Iran that is existing now and has historically existed, and they wouldn't mind seeing it knocked back a little bit. So
I agree that some of their neighbors want Iran further attenuated. I don't think they want to see a broader conflict in the next week. I mean, Saudi actually is terrified of it. They've reportedly, you know, initially they were like, don't do it, and now they're, well, if you're going to do it, we'd like to be at the table to decide, talk about how it's going to happen and play a role in deciding how it gets tamped down. So I agree the point they want them contained, but that's different than saying they want a war that threatens a revolution or other, you know, similar disruption within the country. And certainly the Turks don't want that because they're afraid of the people pouring over their border, including Kurds, which is antithetical to what the government's interested in anyway.
And none of these autocracies want the rise of democracy. I mean, if there's one thing we can say historically in this region, they have risen to power by oppressing the vast majority of the people in the country, and they certainly aren't going to want to give up power, not just because, as you said, that they're going to lose their heads, but also they're going to lose everything. If they can't get all their money out and they can't get out themselves, they don't want to see their entire lifestyle ruined by a bunch of grubby people. They don't believe in democratic uprising, and they have no interest in revolution. Their entire investment in power and their success relies on an ongoing autocracy.
By the way, can I make a broader point? It was Steve Witkoff who said, I don't understand why the Iranians don't come to the table. That guy is frightening. And it's worth mentioning that this set of incentives, if I lose the war, I lose my head, or if I lose power, I lose my head, that also works for Putin currently. He's got a vested interest in keeping that war alive, sort of an Orwellian war is peace view of it. And the fact that Witkoff doesn't seem to understand the incentive systems that are at work in Venezuela, in Iran, and in Russia, go to why it is that our foreign policy is such a, at best, a circus right now, frankly.
Here, here.
Steve Witkoff is probably
I do want to be clear on one thing I was saying. I wasn't saying that I think the Saudis and others want to see significant regime change, major war in Iran. What they want to see is Iran's influence made less. If Iran becomes a nuclear power, right, that's a significant threat to everyone there, right, who not so much oppose Iran, but are trying to have their influence in the same place. And so I really do think it's pressure coming from these other places. And these other places have the money. And the money is what talks to the Trump administration.
All right, we're going to take a break in just a few moments. And before we do that, we are going to let me see what letters have come in the last few moments, because I want to get to those before we move on to anything else. We go to Andrew. Before we have to choose which of the many speeches, counter speeches, rebuttals, commentaries, or counter programming, including avoiding it altogether, to consume this evening, let's think of this question. Is the country in its current state because Donald Trump is the president, or is Donald Trump the president because of the current state of the country? I love that question. That is a great question. We will not know by the end of tonight, but it is a great question. Thank you, Andrew. Very good. Let's see. Please have Allison on more often. Her insight is fantastic, and she has a lot of mic drops to boot. Thank you for your attention to this matter, says Jay. let's see. And then we go to I think I read that one about Bibi and Putin. And this is about an earlier letter. Why don't you call the Republican Party the Republic Party? I do, because I hate them. Just like how people started calling the Democratic Party the Democrat Party because they hated them. It's a derogatory label. Let's face it. I'm 49. I've never heard the expression Democrat Party used until Trump was elected. That from Brian in Poughkeepsie.
But there's nothing wrong with a republic any more than there's something wrong with a Democrat. A republic is simply a governmental system, so you're not really insulting them. Calling them other things that I've called them in the past, which probably are not allowed on the radio, is perfectly acceptable, though.
All right. And only because...
Mic drop.
And only because I have time. But Marion responded. Okay.
Oh.
Fair enough.
Yes. Exactly, Mike. Thank you. Excuse me, but you missed the point about the pejorative use of Democrat as an adjective rather than a noun. All those years that Southerners were Democrats, the nation had the respect to call them Democratic politicians, regardless of the problems with their politics. It is long after... the Southern Democrats ceased to hold power that Southerners started calling us the Democrat Party. The problem with replacing an adjective with a noun has nothing to do with the long history of racist Southern Democrats. Have some respect for those of us who write in to occasionally have our letters read by not completely disregarding the meaning of the letter and arguing a point the letter writer didn't make.
Well, I think you did make that point, but I would also point out that, like, Jesse Helms was a Democrat.
Yes.
Well, if it offers you any consolation...
He was a member of the Democrat Party.
If it,
yeah, but he wouldn't have been referred to that way. And I think she's making a real point there, which is that it returned into the conversation. Whatever used to be the case, for a long time, it was not being used as an insult. And now the Democrat Party is the term being used by...
Mark Whitman.
I must say I love public radio, Joe, and I mean it sincerely. If it's any consolation to Marion, we actually did spend much of the break right after that letter literally going through the definition, practical use of the word historically and talked about its formal meaning versus the informal versus the use of it as a title. So I do think it was a worthwhile contribution, and the fact that someone wants to round it off at the edges, Marion shouldn't feel that she hasn't contributed to the way we think. And I do believe, Joe, sometimes we all gasp when people call us on informal language, particularly in a quickly spoken program, but I still think it matters.
It absolutely does. We'll be back right after this short break. I just want to quickly mention the music we're playing is fantastic this morning. We're very excited. It's Branford Marsalis, who is playing Universal Preservation Hall in Saratoga Springs on Friday night. I'll say two things. One, Branford Marsalis is an absolute genius. David Gustina years ago did an interview with Branford. It was a fantastic, fantastic interview, and I learned a lot about him then. And he's going to be at UPH, which I've said this before and I'll say it again, is one of the greatest venues in our region. It's a fantastic place to see anything, but certainly to see Branford Marsalis, who is a legend and from a legendary musical family, the Marsalis family. Yep. That happens on Friday night at UPH, at uph.org, the word A-T, atuph.org, to find out more information. And that will be a very, very special evening. Was a band leader for The Tonight Show.
Yeah, I actually saw him live one time. Yeah,
good stuff. The playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. wamc.org/roundtable. Okay. Let's go to Jack Smith. Judge, stop me if you've heard any of this before. A federal judge in Florida blocked public release of special counsel Jack Smith's extensive report on the classified documents case against President Donald Trump, a resounding victory for Trump's efforts to block public viewing of what probably would be damaging details about his retention of classified materials after he left the White House in 2021. The decision Monday morning came from, and this is the tell me if you've heard this name before, U.S. District Judge Aileen Cannon, resulted from litigation that has dragged on for more than a year in her courtroom. Cannon ruled that releasing the special counsel report could violate grand jury secrecy rules and could result in impugning the presumption of innocence for Trump and his co-defendants in a case that did not result in guilty verdicts. The ruling can be appealed, although Trump and the Justice Department both opposed the public release of the report. First Amendment advocacy groups and media outlets pushed in Cannon's court for release. Smith charged Trump in 2023 with 40 counts of illegally retaining classified defense information and obstructing government efforts to retrieve the materials. Two of Trump's personal aides were charged with obstruction alongside him. Cannon dismissed those charges in a decision that broke with legal precedent, ruling that Smith was unlawfully appointed and therefore had no authority to bring charges. Her decision did not touch on the merits of the case, which Trump aides at the time believed was the strongest of the criminal cases against Trump that were brought during the Biden administration. Smith appealed the ruling but dropped the appeal after Trump won the 2024 presidential election, citing federal regulations that say a sitting president cannot be prosecuted. In her Monday ruling, Cannon lambasted Smith for compiling the report, even though she dismissed the charges in 2024. Using the discovery in the case to complete the report amounted to circumventing her ruling, she said. In the final days before Trump took office, Smith submitted the final report to then Attorney General Merrick Garland. Garland did not push to release it because at the time, an appeal of Cannon's dismissal order was still pending at the Justice Department. All of that reporting from the Washington Post. Mark Whitman.
Joe, this is going in. It's not the way back machine, but it's the back machine. Frankly, I think there's a general consensus as to what Trump and the alleged co-conspirators did here. I don't think there's a lot of mystery to it. I don't need the long form report. And by the way, I don't think Aileen Cannon should be the nexus of our belief that Trump didn't receive justice, because the Supreme Court proved that it was going to delay things for as long as it could, if not forever, in the way it handled some of the decisions around Trump, including the immunity decision. So this is a little bit of an echo from the past, but I'm not really sure how meaningful it is, to be honest. Maybe someone can prove me wrong.
There was a suggestion in the Washington Post piece that there may be information in there that has not been made public. When the first chapter one of the Jack Smith reports about the January 6th incident, when he released that, it just confirmed a lot of information that had already been well reported and it was in the congressional record already. And some are speculating that they want to get this public because there's even more evidence that is more convincing and more harmful, hurtful, whatever, to Trump. And I don't think it matters. I kind of agree with you, Mark. I mean, I'd like to see it. I'd like to see it get out in the interest of public the freedom of First Amendment, freedoms of the press, and you name it. But I don't think it's going to convince anybody who's not already convinced, and I don't think it's going to change anyone's opinion about what happened with those records in Florida. All you have to do is look at the picture of the piles of records he took from the White House and stored in a bathroom down in Mar-a-Lago, and you kind of know the story.
So, you know, one of the things that I do find it interesting is not the right word in this story and so many others is just how long these things can drag on if the sides want them to, and especially with a judge like Cannon. So now it'll go to an appeal, right? The appeal theoretically takes out of Cannon's space. But again, often what happens is the appeal overrules a piece of it, goes back down, goes back up. So my guess is we'll still be talking about this, you know, 2 years from now as something that's in its 15th appeal, or, you know, it may eventually get to the Supreme Court. But this one, my guess is, can get bounced around so long that it's exactly what you said. We don't really care anymore. And people aren't going to be upset when they find out that, you know, some of what he took home with him were nuclear plans and things like that that are just super highly classified, because, as you say, he's just done so much more. It just bothers me that these things can't move faster, that the things that the government pushes move very quickly up to the Supreme Court, which can then use the secret docket, and the things that are going through the legal process, quote, correctly, unquote, can take forever.
It does look like there's an appeal for the 11th Circuit brought by the Knight First Amendment Institute and the American Oversight Committee, and those look to be decided, start arguing in June. Hmm. Depending on how big that decision is, it would either send it back to Cannon or possibly chuck it back up to the next level of review. The challenge, I think, of dealing with the legal system as a means of arbitrating abuses of power is that it is slow. It's necessarily slow. And the news cycle is incredibly fast. And to keep your eye on this bowl when there are so many other bowls being thrown at you is hard. But I want to argue that I think this is one to watch, not because we should be immune to him abusing power by now or lying in public or using his power to protect himself, but because I think when you have federal judges who are in the pocket of or being obedient to the executive branch, what we see is the further erosion of our three branches of government and the separation of powers. And since the Hur report was released, and it did probably damage Biden to some extent, I think this much more clear statement of guilt that Smith has described here should be publicly released, and Trump should have to publicly apologize for stealing American documents. He won't, but that is what I think should happen. I also think Congress should start doing its job. So I have a lot of dreams.
So you want him to be held accountable?
I do. I do want that. I have a dream.
That's so cute. It's so
cute.
Yeah,
it's
cute.
It's so cute.
We try. All right. Anybody else on that? Hearing none, we will take a break. When we come back, we'll wrap up the show. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for a lively group this morning. It's 10:45. We have about 13 minutes left in the show. We can get a lot done in that period of time. Mike Spain is here. So is Jim Henler, Mark Whitman, and Allison Cavey. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We would love to hear what is on your mind regarding the issues that we're talking about this morning. Let's go to another issue. I assume we are done on the Jack Smith report. Is that correct? All right. Jim, you're up next. Let's talk about after a deadly raid, an AI power struggle erupts at the Pentagon. I find this frightening. I want you to tell me that I should not be frightened by this. I don't know whether you will or not, but let's try it out. One of the nation's leading AI, artificial intelligence firms, is negotiating whether it can continue to work with the military, according to people familiar with the discussions after Pentagon officials called their once close relationship into question in the wake of January's raid to capture the Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro. Follow along. Anthropic's Claude model is one of a handful of leading AI systems that the Pentagon is using to rapidly build its capabilities in cyber warfare, improve the performance of its autonomous weapons systems, and increase the efficiency of its personnel. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's team has insisted in recent weeks that the military must have the freedom to use the powerful tools as it sees fit. Officials say other leading AI firms have gone along with the demand. OpenAI, the maker of ChatGPT, Google, and Elon Musk's XAI, have agreed to allow the Pentagon to use their systems for, quote, all lawful purposes on unclassified networks, a defense official said. They are working on agreements for classified networks. The companies did not respond to requests for comment, but Anthropic, which has sought to position itself as the most safety-minded of the companies, has corporate principles that may keep it from giving the Pentagon carte blanche. Unlike many traditional weapons, powerful AI systems can be deployed in many ways not foreseen by their designers, and the dispute has raised questions about who should have the final say over their use by the military. From the Washington Post, Ian Duncan and Tara Kopp.
So I will point out just a little bit of an advertisement that if you listen to Vox Pop today, we're doing an AI show. But
2 o'clock I think, on WAMC, 90.3 on your FM dial. Go ahead. 1400 on your AM dial.
I was going to say it. Yeah. Luckily, the lockbox isn't in play, or we'd be talking for another 10 minutes. Anyway. So a little more than almost 2 years ago now, under a different administration, the Pentagon released a set of principles for use of AI within the Department of Defense. One of Trump's first executive orders was to rip that up and say anything that puts any kind of constraints on AI is bad. Right. Because we'll be handing China or something out, you know, but basically it's because all these big companies put mega dollars into his election, things like that. However, there's been a lot of pushback on the part of the developers. Right. When Google first signed a contract to use AI in a particular system, when it got out what that system was really doing rather than what they had been told, the Google employees said, we won't work on it anymore, and Google withdrew from the contract. That was long enough ago that Google was not quite where it is now. We're in this so-called AI race. They all want to be in there. But they all backed this thing which said, let's get rid of ethics. Let's not have a policy thing. So there have been a lot of different potential circumstances. I teach an entire course on AI policy, ethics, et cetera. We won't do the whole course here. But the key thing is the Trump administration's belief is rip this all up, no regulation, and that leaves it to the companies to make their own decisions. Anthropic had a agreement with the Pentagon about how it would be used. I no longer have the clearances where I could know the details, but I can guess an awful lot of them. A lot of what goes on within the military is understanding information coming from all over the place, right? What's being reported in these newspapers around the world? What are these people thinking? What are we getting in the... So it's analysis. That's something AI is very good at, right? A lot of us now will say, give me a summary on such and such an issue, and then I'll kind of look through it to see what we agree and disagree with. That's the use that Anthropic agreed to. The autonomous weapons gets much more complicated. It's something we've had for a very long time. It's not really the same as an autonomous vehicle or something like that. There's always a human somewhere, what's called in the loop or on the loop. And again, Anthropic was willing to say, as long as it's humans who make the final decision, you can use our software. But mainly it's to empower decision making. No one's quite sure what was done in Venezuela that went beyond that, but clearly something did. And so Anthropic is standing by the deal it made and saying, hey, you know, when we agreed to move into the secure systems, we agreed you wouldn't do certain things. Now you're doing them. And supposing Hegseth is having a meeting today with the CEO of Anthropic, we'll see what happens about that. You know, this is yet another case of people with a lot of money and a lot of investment being forced into making deals. And those deals are starting to go against some of their ethics. And that's really scary to some of those of us who have helped create this technology, but more importantly, see the positive uses it could be put to, the things it could do that would be so helpful to society versus the things that it's being used for, which is to help a government do things that don't agree with the ethics of the developers and the people making these systems. And so it's a complicated story.
So yes, Mark.
Oh, no, if you have a...
No, please.
First of all, I took Anthropic's reluctance as a branding opportunity. It wants to say, consistent with what it's done in other realms, it's the safe ethical choice. And I think they're publicizing this, and they're happy to publicize it. And if they get thrown out of the Pentagon, they're making the decision that that's the better way to make money. I actually asked AI to look at this question for me, and I worked it through to what I actually thought was a pretty good summary of the challenges we face. And basically, during the 20th century, we faced a technology powerful enough to end civilization, right? We survived it. But the guardrails we used to use were deterrence, arms control, and safety measures. Deterrence was clear, right? It worked because launch meant catastrophe. AI is different. It's a different challenge because systems can analyze footage faster than humans. And the stakes become not a fear of annihilation, right, but being outpaced. So deterrence here becomes a bit of a race. Arms control here is much tougher. The second one, nukes used to be counted. You could see them from a satellite. AI code, you can't see it. And exposing it, you weaken it. And so transparency, which had been the backbone of arms control, is far harder with these algorithms. And finally, safety, right? Nuclear weapons develop safeguards, two-person rules, strict authorizations, thresholds. The problem for AI, although it can be hacked and fed bad data, right, is that if AI flags a threat, the issue is you have to respond quickly, even faster than humans can think or certainly extract diplomacy. So it's clear we have a new set of challenges. And the way we used to protect ourselves from nuclear threats won't work here. And we've got to start working on other safeguards. Otherwise, we'll all be, you know, having those Sting and Men at Work songs about the annihilation. It'll just be a different reason.
So, you know, just so you know, I won't read it, but you can also ask AI to argue exactly the opposite. Why should the military do it? And it will give you just as many good reasons, right? The thing to understand about AI is it's answering the question you asked the way it thinks you want it answered. It's not nuanced. It's not presenting multiple views. It will occasionally throw in something. So again, just be careful when you say, I've used AI to help me bolster argument X. Make sure you also try to have it make the other argument and then compare in your own head the two.
We have 2 minutes. Go ahead.
So I think we also need to consider the bigger repercussions of AI for the democratic process. And there's a nice example right now in the 12th Congressional District, Jerry Nadler's district. And one of the people who's running is a gentleman called Alex Boris. And he is a former Palantir employee who designed the AI tech that has been responsible for using ICE. He resigned from Palantir because of that. And yet, a super PAC, which is part of leading the future, has been funding ads saying, you don't want to vote for him because he's the one who came up with this tech. They don't mention that that's why he resigned. So when we look at the human implications of AI, we have to think about how unscrupulous people can use our anxieties and our concerns about it against us. And I think one of the reasons Boris is an important person to consider here is he's saying, I resign. I have the technological knowledge. I resigned because of how it was being used by ICE. And I think we need to have experts in Congress who are capable of talking about this, because having a bunch of people who don't actually know how it works is how we got here with social media. It's how we got here with TikTok. It's how we got here with Facebook. And it's that kind of willful ignorance combined with capitalist profit that is probably going to drag down our ability to maintain human democracy in the face of AI intelligence.
What? Just have one little one to add to that. Thanks. The Axios today is reporting that the Pentagon has come to an agreement with Elon Musk to use his Grok in classified systems.
Yep.
And they're saying the big rub on working with Anthropic's Claude was that they insisted that it be used for mass surveillance of Americans in addition to automated weaponry. And so it does tell you how crazy things are.
And with that, we get ready to watch the State of the Union address tonight, and we'll talk about it on tomorrow's program. It will be aired on this very radio station tonight, beginning at 9 o'clock, brought to you from our friends at NPR. My thanks to my friends, Mike Spain, Jim Hendler, Mark Whitman, and Allison Cavey. Also a reminder, Jim will be back at 2 o'clock this afternoon with Ray Graff, and we'll be talking about AI, much more to discuss there. Thank you all. We'll be back right after this.